Daly. I'm the founder of the UK charity Yes to Life and your regular host for the Yes to Life show. This week, I'm going to be finding out some more about a subject that I know very little about, mesothelioma. If you didn't know, this is a particular form of cancer that's a result of inhaling asbestos fibres. When I was young, asbestos was all the rage. Industry just couldn't get enough of it and was filling our homes, schools, hospitals and workplace with it as fast as possible. I can remember my dad buying tins of asbestos fibre and powder. Yep, death in a tin that you moistened to use as raw plugs. Hard to believe, but true. All of this despite the conclusive evidence that it was a killer being available from about 1930. It's another scandal on the level of tobacco, where commercial interest has drowned out public safety for decades. Anyway, we're now reaping a harvest of death and suffering as a consequence, and mesothelioma is a really tough disease to counter. I'm talking over Skype to two people who are trying to help in this area. Liz Darlison, who's Director of Services at Mesothelioma UK, and Karen Lord, who has a new post supporting people with the disease in Leicester and elsewhere. Hi, Karen and Liz. Very nice for you to come on the show today to tell us a bit more about mesothelioma, which is a subject that not that many people know about.
You're very welcome. Thank you for inviting us.
Great. So, Karen, you're newly appointed as a clinical nurse specialist at Glenfield Hospital, I understand. And Liz, you're the director of services at Mesothelioma UK. And your organisation's actually funded Karen to take this post.
That's right, yes.
Well, that's a great thing. I understand you're the 13th to take up this role, so you've got to be making a difference.
I think so. That's the whole intention.
So mesothelioma is something that most people struggle to even say the word, let alone have any appreciation or understanding of it. But it's my understanding that the cases are rising now and that help with dealing with it is pretty thin on the ground. So can you start off by telling me just how common it is and what the current survival rates for it are?
Yeah, I can do. I mean, I think it's like lots of diseases and ill health problems, until it comes knocking on your door, affects someone close to you. You've often never heard of these things, but unfortunately, yes, you're quite right. Mesothelioma is growing in numbers. The UK, unfortunately, has the highest incidence in the world.
Wow!
And that directly correlates to how much asbestos we used in the last century.
Mm.
So we've got the highest incidence. It's growing. There's about 2,500 cases per year, and really the only known cause is exposure to asbestos. So once diagnosed, the outlook is quite bleak, unfortunately, although we are in optimistic times currently, because we have got a number of clinical trials open and the treatment options are improving every month, actually. But generally speaking, the outlook is quite poor, so it isn't a curable cancer. It's very treatable, but we haven't got a cure, and survival is very limited. So around 50% of people will not live beyond a year after they're diagnosed.
Wow, so that puts it right up with some of the worst cancers.
It is a very challenging cancer for everyone concerned, of course, not least for the person who's diagnosed with it.
Mm. Okay, so maybe we can start with the basics. What is it, and why do people have it? You've already mentioned asbestos, which, of course, is what it's all about. So maybe you could just describe a bit why asbestos has this effect.
Yeah, so mesothelioma, it's a cancer of mesothelial cells, and mesothelial cells are found in the membranes that line our major cavities, so your chest cavity and your abdominal cavity. And so mesothelial cells are in the membrane that lines those cavities. And we think what happens is that somewhere in their younger life, a person has inhaled or potentially ingested, so on their food, but mostly it's inhaled some asbestos fibres into their lung that have worked their way through the lung tissue and embedded themselves in the outer edge of the lung. This is called the pleura. And then over a number of years, there's been some inflammation, some swelling, and you know, the cancer process has begun. And unfortunately, it's often 20, 30 years later that the person starts to get symptoms, and that's when the mesothelioma, the cancer, is diagnosed.
Right. Okay, well, that starts to explain the next question I was going to ask you. Is the worst forms of asbestos, the blue and brown, were banned in 1985, and the white was banned in 1999. But actually, the numbers are going up. It's killing more people than ever. So this partly explains why is this huge time delay before actually it turns into cancer.
That's right. Although we were really high consumers of brown asbestos, and we didn't legislate as quickly to protect people from brown asbestos, which we think is probably why we've got this really high incidence still. White asbestos, there's still quite a lot of controversy. We know that it's less carcinogenic than brown and blue, but there is still, you know, quite a lot of divided opinion, really, about how dangerous it is. Currently, you know, we consider that it's still asbestos, and yes, it can cause mesothelioma.
Hmm. So brown asbestos was used for what?
I think the most common thing was asbestos boarding. But to be honest, that's not our area of expertise, so we're not asbestos experts at all. No. But I think asbestos boarding, asbestos sheeting. Mm. But outside of that, you know, we're probably not the best people to ask.
Right. Okay, so now if you go, we'll go a little bit into the mechanism. Now, you've said that it embeds itself in this lining of the organs, particularly the lungs. And so this is a case where it's actually just causing inflammation, chronic inflammation all the time. Is that right?
Well, for some people, it remains like that. So there's a few different diseases that asbestos can cause or health problems. And the first one, you know, and mesothelioma, of course, is the sharp end of the wedge. It's the most challenging of all of them. But we think that most of them start with an inflammatory process caused by the asbestos embedding itself in the tissue. And your body's natural defence mechanisms try to engulf it, to rid the body of it.
Yes.
But it is pretty indestructible. So that's how it starts. But the mechanism beyond that, I think, you know, it's not very interesting. And you know, I don't think it's fully understood, if I'm honest.
Right. And this is because maybe it hasn't been a common enough disease previously? Hasn't been studied enough?
I think in part, you know, I think that there's lots of reasons why there's not been investment in research into mesothelioma, and I think probably the numbers haven't been there. I think that, you know, often we think about protecting people, we legislate about the use of asbestos, and then you get complacent, forgetting that obviously it's still in the fabric of our building. I think the poor survival, you know, people's voices lost because they don't live long enough with the disease to fight for changes in, you know, in funding. So there's a number of reasons why there has been a lack of investment.
Mm. And how much asbestos does it take to cause this kind of problem?
Well, it varies for the asbestos diseases, you know, for the range of asbestos diseases. But for mesothelioma in particular, there is no reason why one single fibre can't cause. So there is no safe level of asbestos. That is, you know, without doubt, we know that. And unfortunately, you know, our clinics are littered with people who've had very low levels of casual exposure to asbestos. So there is no safe level.
Mm. So maybe, can we just sort of go over a few of the ways in which people might have been exposed to asbestos?
Yeah. I mean, I think, like I said, nobody is spared the risk of an asbestos-related disease in the UK, because we were such high consumers of asbestos that it is still everywhere in our environment. You know, our schools, our hospitals, our universities still contain asbestos. And there are people lobbying and trying to get government to change legislation and to invest to remove that risk. So there are lots of ways you could have been exposed. I mean, people just going to schools, the number of school teachers developing mesothelioma is worrying. You know, I think everybody can look back and remember science lessons when they're you know, the asbestos mats, you know, with a Bunsen burner.
Yes.
Or just domestic science or cooking classes where, you know, the ovens were lined with asbestos seals, and your oven gloves were made of asbestos fabric. You know, your ironing board at home. Think about the jackets around in our airing cupboard. Fascias and soffits on houses, asbestos boarding, floor tiles. You know, the list is endless. It was in plentiful supply. It was very pliable, very cheap, and totally fire retardant. So it was a wonderful substance. Apart from the fact that it kills people.
Right. So beyond actually handling the stuff, which these days, people are not tending to handle it, because it's all the items that were made out of it, which are kicking around like ironing boards and things, have largely gone now. But nonetheless, it's in the fabric of our buildings, as you say. Are there ways in which people are being exposed just by being in buildings that have got it in there?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and that's part of the problem. Because it's such a pliable substance, it is hidden in the fabric of our buildings. And people often don't realise that their floor tiles may be made of asbestos. There was a massive craze to cover our houses in Artex in the 70s and 80s, and everybody had Artex. Well, we know that the substance that Artex is made from had asbestos in it. You know, the Health and Safety Executive website is one of the best sources of information. If you want to see where asbestos is lurking in domestic properties, then the HSE website is a great resource for everybody to look at.
Is there anything we can intelligently do to reduce the risk of exposure? I mean, you know, we just basically a victim of these circumstances, or can we protect ourselves somehow?
I think, my personal feeling, having worked with this disease all these years, is I think that we need to have some kind of government programme and investment for a long-term plan, and that's not for this generation or the next, it's for the third, fourth and fifth generation ahead, you know, for the long-term reduction of risk from asbestos in our country. We need to have a five-generation plan for how we're going to remove asbestos from the fabric of our buildings. And until we do that, you know, to keep saying that it's safe as long as it's not disturbed, or, you know, you're just delaying the problem, because at some point or another, the fabric of the building is going to be such that it's going to need some kind of renovation work, DIY, makeover, course what you want. And so at some point it is going to be disturbed. So that's my personal view, that we should have a long term. But, you know, the current society doesn't think long term. We're a disposable nation. Everything is for, you know, for here, for now, a quick fix, and that's the nation we've become, you know, or the human race has become that way, certainly in the developed world. So, you know, it's going against current thinking, I think. But I think it's not for our children, it's for our children's grandchildren that we need to have some kind of long-term plan. Because for those of us that work with asbestos-related diseases day in and day out, you know, low levels of asbestos are killing people day in and day out. We have to have, it's a humane responsibility that we carry today, and that we have to do something.
One of the forces that often does drive progress in these areas when the government isn't doing its bit is actually money. And I'm wondering whether you think there would be any case whereby the health implications of asbestos would mean that insurance on different properties and things could, life insurance could actually come into play and actually make it in the interests of people to make sure their houses are asbestos free.
It's really hard, isn't it, to do the maths and work out where the benefits can be made, you know, where the savings can be made and the redirected. And, you know, I think we just have to take a step back from that and just think currently, if I said to you that the current first line standard treatment for mesothelioma, the drugs alone, the cost per cycle of treatment is around about £6,500-£7,000, and that's every 3 weeks.
Wow.
You know, the problem is that the way we manage, the way we housekeep, is in silos. So it, you know, the money never gets redirected when savings are made in any way, shape or form. So, you know, it's always got to be an upfront investment, hasn't it? And I just think we can't afford not to do something.
Right.
We can't afford to just ignore this problem. Not in this country. Mm. Not in this country, we can't.
So it's an awareness issue, really, isn't it? Because, I mean, until you said, even though I'm dealing with cancer day in, day out, I wasn't aware of the fact that we were right up the top of the league table for a start. That's quite a shock piece of news for me. And I also couldn't have said with certainty before today that the numbers who are being contracting mesothelioma are going up. I thought it might be at least plateauing by now. But so, you know, it is a worse picture than even somebody who's involved in the area would realise. So, we, you know, obviously needs the awareness raised considerably before something will happen.
Here's just a couple of statistics for you. So 20 tradesmen die every week due to mesothelioma.
Wow.
If you're a carpenter and you were born in the 1940s, you've got a 1 in 17 chance of dying from mesothelioma.
Right.
And, you know, they are stark statistics, really. And so, you know, I think I've become a little bit, tunnel visioned over the years. But to me, it beggars belief that, you know, people overlook these statistics. Now, whether that's because, you know, a lot of these people are, you know, retired before, but, you know, they were out earning a living when they were exposed to this substance, you know, and supporting their family, propping up the nation, call it what you like. And I just think it's an absolute travesty on every front, really.
Mm, I agree with you. And I'm glad that some people have got tunnel vision about it, because we need people like you to speak up for this, because obviously the people who are most affected, they're dying, I mean, quite quickly. So it's a tough nut to crack.
Yeah, they lose their voice. They're too...
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is terrible, really.
Yeah. Okay. So the dangers of asbestos, they were first picked up more than a century ago, and they were clearly appreciated by 1930. So, you know, we had more than 50 years, basically, of going berserk, putting asbestos into everything, as you describe, in this country before it was actually banned. And, yeah, it did include, as you said, places like hospitals and schools. You know, I can remember being in a school that had, asbestos sort of ceiling tiles, things like this. They were touted as great things to keep us safe. Those kind of forces that were at work keeping the whole show on the road, do you think we're any better placed now to avoid the next great health crisis, you know, caused by similar forces?
Well, it's hard to know, isn't it? What is going to be the next big health crisis? I mean, if we look at HIV, that came along and scared so many people. But, you know, we've invested, we've done incredible, excellent research, and we now have really effective treatment for HIV.
Right.
And it's hard to see where the next, you know, I mean, I suppose we worry about all of the, you know, mobile phone kind of situation. And so I don't know. I don't know, really. I make no excuse. I am tunnel visioned, or I'm an anorak about this disease. And
right.
I find it hard to smash out of that box and think about broader health issues sometimes.
Mm, well, fair enough. But it's just like, what's very stark for you and for me is to think that they would, you know, that a situation was able to be generated with where this known killer was being used more and more and more extensively in all the places where our children are, where, you know, we work, everything else, for more than 50 years after they knew that it killed you. And, you know, that's the worst thing. Okay, fair enough when people don't know, you know, they make mistakes, for sure. But this is something different, isn't it?
Yeah, and it does beg a belief, but don't even get me started on what's happening in the rest of the world, because less than, you know, I think it's just over a quarter of the world has banned asbestos. And even in those countries that have banned it, some of them probably only banned it on paper so that they could join the EU, for instance, meet some entry criteria or something. So there are so many countries that are still using asbestos and in increasing amounts. Mm. You know, that even more emphasises why we, with the nation with the highest incidence, have to do something to get it right. Because what we learn here, we probably should, be sharing it, globally to help.
Yes, absolutely. Okay, well, look, let's go to the other side of things now. Let's have a look at the treatment, what's on offer, and have the treatments improved in the last decade or so?
Yes, they have. I mean, as I say, I've worked in this disease for a number of years now, best part of two decades, and, the treatments have improved considerably. And currently, the licensed treatments haven't improved a great deal, so those approved it to be used in the NHS. Because there hasn't been, the investment in research, but we've currently got a whole portfolio of clinical trials that are either now open or in development. And clinical trials brings with it opportunity and hope for patients. And, you don't tend to find, the magic pill to treat diseases and cancer in particular. No. It's a small chipping away, slow improvement year on year through good quality randomized controlled trials. And so the number of trials that got open can only be a good thing. And slowly we will push out, improvements in terms of symptom management and survival. And only investment research can bring that about. And it is happening. So yes, we have, a number of centres around the UK that are quite dedicated to developing our national portfolio of clinical studies. So, it's exciting stuff.
So this is, when you say you have a number of centres around the UK, you're talking about Mesothelioma UK has?
No, I mean we've got NHS hospitals that have got clinical teams that are developing their expertise and opening up clinical trials. So, I just think we've got a great team in Glasgow with a portfolio of trials, Bristol, Cambridge, Leicester, Manchester, I could go on and on, Southampton, there's some in London. But these are, clinical teams who have got an academic and a clinical interest in this disease that are investing their expertise into developing clinical trials.
Okay, so what's a likely course of treatment for a recently diagnosed patient then?
It's very varied. There are a number of things that can actually affect your eligibility for treatment. Not least personal preference. Some people, once they hear what's available, they really don't want to. They might want to go off and do a world tour or something. But anyway, generally fitness, there are other health problems. They can have an impact on what's available. But for all patients, usually, that are generally fit enough, chemotherapy is a standard treatment that is licensed, approved for use in the NHS, and somewhere around about 35% of patients at the first line will have treatment with chemotherapy. There are surgical procedures that are available to help manage some of the symptoms of mesothelioma, and some of those surgical procedures can be quite invasive, quite radical. There are only a few centres in the country that are able to offer the full range, but as I say, there are surgical procedures. But again, it comes down to patient fitness, other health problems, and personal preferences. Mm. And then radiotherapy. So,
okay, just before we move on to radiotherapy, maybe you could describe what the surgical procedures are trying to achieve.
Well, we've got a clinical trial open currently in the UK called the MARS-2 study. And MARS is an acronym, mesothelioma and radical surgery. Mm-hmm. And this study is a randomised trial. All of the patients have two cycles of chemotherapy. And then if their disease is contained enough for it to be removed, they'll then randomise to have surgery or not. The surgery involves... It's basically... I explained earlier that mesothelioma is a disease of the lining of mm-hmm. the major cavity. So the surgery involved in the MARS-2 study is peeling off the lining of the cavity, peeling it off of the underlying lung, so removing the tumour from the underlying lung.
Yes.
And it's a very skilled and specialist surgical procedure. But so, you know, that is the surgery, and they very carefully and slowly peel this membrane that lines the chest cavity off of the underlying lung bit by bit to remove all of the tumour that's involved in that lining.
Okay, yeah.
And that's called an extended pleurectomy decortication, an extended pleurectomy decortication.
Not a snappy title, but I can understand why it's called that. Yes. Okay, that's good. So, and then you were saying there's radiotherapy available as well.
That's right. So radiotherapy, we know that mesothelioma is sensitive to radiotherapy, and we use radiotherapy to control small areas of disease and also where there is disease that is causing pain and discomfort. We'll use radiotherapy to treat those areas as well. So often patients can have a combination of all three treatments. So they can have surgery, chemotherapy and radiotherapy. And of course, underpinning all of this across for all patients, we use good symptom control, and we work with specialist palliative care teams in hospital and in local hospices and out in the community as well.
Right. So just to go into a bit more detail on that, when you say symptom control, you're talking about symptoms of the disease or symptoms of the treatment, or both?
We're talking about both, really, but if we think about the symptoms of disease, we know some of the ones that we're looking out for. Not everyone gets these symptoms, but those that do can come up with some quite complex pain issues in their chest, for example, and sometimes shortness of breath or cough can be others that trouble patients. And so it's very important that we control these symptoms as far as possible, so that people's quality of life is maintained, so that they can be eligible also for the clinical trials that are available, since you need to be able to function at quite high levels on a day-to-day basis to be fit enough, in other words, to be eligible for these trials. So having your symptoms controlled and having access to expertise who can advise patients on this is really important, both for their quality of life and for their eligibility for treatment.
I see, yeah. Okay, and I mean, one of the things that sets mesothelioma apart from most other cancers is the fact that, unfortunately, you've got this causal thing, you've got these fibres in there, and all your treatments are obviously are aimed at the cancer, which is the result of it. But actually, are there any strategies whatsoever in the pipeline or in use which are to actually try and remove the cause, remove the asbestos fibres?
No, it's of little relevance by the time you get to the stage where mesothelioma is present. So the asbestos fibres, we don't measure them, we don't pay any regard to the presence of those asbestos fibres, really, unless occasionally when the pathologists are examining biopsy specimens and so on, they may comment on the number of asbestos fibres that they have seen, which can be useful for patients when they're pursuing civil claims and so on. But generally speaking, it's of no clinical relevance. It doesn't impact on the patient's treatment or their management in any way.
Right. But you said there's no such thing as a minimum level, safe level, if you like, of asbestos exposure. But does it make any difference whether you've got a lot of asbestos fibres or a little? I assume it does.
Well, we know that there is a correlation between asbestos burden and the likelihood of you getting asbestos-related diseases. So there is a dose, a relationship with the dose.
Yes.
But in terms of how your whatever disease you have, doesn't matter whether it's mesothelioma, asbestosis, or lung cancer, for instance. Actually, at that point when you're diagnosed with an asbestos-related disease, the asbestos burden or the asbestos count doesn't have any impact on your clinical management at all.
Right. Okay, that's fair enough. I realise there's another question I haven't asked you, which is you mentioned asbestosis, and how does this differ from mesothelioma?
Well, asbestosis I explained that mesothelioma is a disease of the lining of the cavity, where asbestosis is actually a disease of the lung tissue itself. So here the asbestos fibres have embedded themselves in the lung tissue, not worked their way to the edge and to the lining, and cause that inflammatory process in the lung tissue itself And those areas of lung tissue actually become non-functioning over a period of time. So they don't exchange oxygen and carbon dioxide. And it's a slowly progressive disease associated with quite chronic breathlessness. And in honest, you know, in truth, the numbers of asbestosis patients is decreasing because it's usually very high levels of exposure to asbestos that can result in asbestosis. And because of legislation and the banning of asbestos and so on, then, you know, we're not seeing patients with those high levels of exposure so much.
So that has actually improved. So it's not cancer as such. It's a malfunctioning of the lung. The lung is not actually functioning as it should.
Okay.
One other question about the whole process. So we've got a cause in these fibres, we've got a process of inflammation, and then we've got eventually the emergence of cancer. Is there anything people can do about the process of inflammation?
Not as far as I'm aware, but there is lots that all of us can do in terms of helping prevent our risk of developing cancer, and that's any cancer. And there's lots of government health education material to, looking at that. So, you know, avoid too much sunlight, think about the amount of alcohol you're drinking, obesity is a contributory factor, smoking, of course, lack of exercise, looking at your diet in terms of having a rainbow diet, plenty of fresh fruit and vegetables. So, and all of that stands fast for preventing any cancer, of course. So, there is lots that you can do. And I can't tell you scientifically that actually helps prevent mesothelioma, but it, you know, statistically speaking, you know, as a woman, I'm far more at risk of developing breast cancer, and as a man, you're more at risk of developing prostate cancer. And you know, we have to put it in context of statistics, really. So good health education holds fast for preventing any cancer. And, you know, people... I hope that will also help in the prevention of mesothelioma, but I can't tell you scientifically that it does.
Okay. Just saying all the good advice for keeping your body in good shape is likely to protect you as much from these fibres actually going from being inflammation to being cancer as any other kind of cancer you might get for any other reason.
Exactly. Exactly that. Yeah.
So
that's the hope.
Some people, do we know for a fact that some people get through the whole of their lives with asbestos fibres in their lungs and don't get mesothelioma?
Yes, absolutely. You know, there are people who develop benign asbestos-related scarring, pleural plaques we call that, who've had worked in asbestos industries and, you know, have them all their life and never go on to develop any malignancy. So, yes, that is perfectly possible.
Well, that's good to hear. So it's not a kind of fait accompli that if you realise you were exposed at some time, you haven't got cancer yet, but you're not necessarily going to get it if you look after yourself well.
That's right, yeah.
Okay, well, that's interesting. Okay, and could you describe some of the latest developments that are in the line? You say that these trials are happening. What's new about the trials?
It's no different to meso to other cancers, if I'm honest, that what we're seeing in clinical trials is this, it's almost an explosion in the number of trials using targeted drugs. So drugs that target the genetics of the cancer as opposed to systemic chemotherapy treatment. Sometimes it still feels that we're a little bit blindfolded in that some of the treatments that we're using, we can't be sure that mesothelioma actually hosts the target that drug is aimed at necessarily. But generally speaking, I think, that's the difference. These trials that we have open currently, there's a number of firms that are open and they are using these targeted drugs that have very low side effects. So they're very well tolerated by patients.
That's good.
Yeah. Means that more patients can access the trials. And there's just, you know, the choice that patients have got now is it's just so different to how it's been for the last 20 years. So I think that's the biggest difference, really.
Okay, and I mean, it's probably too early to say, but is there good reason to think that actually there might be some better results from these, from the targeted treatments?
There's every, yeah, absolutely. There's every reason to hope that we are definitely going to see in some of our national audit data improvements in terms of patient outcomes.
And when will that kind of information be available?
I thought that'd be your next question. I was going to follow on by saying, but of course, there's always a time lag. So, you know, it takes a few years for these trials to report and for us to see the evidence. Although, you know, because of the number of drugs that are coming out onto the market, that time lag is getting less and less. So, but it's usually a couple of years before we get to see the results of clinical trials.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so with most cancers, early detection is always described as a good thing, and the chances of success in treating it are always better. Is that true of mesothelioma?
Well, that's a tough one, really, because we haven't got, or we haven't had historically, a huge kit bag of treatments for the disease. And so, you know, early diagnosis didn't necessarily mean, it meant that you get into treatment sooner, but it didn't necessarily change the outcome.
Right.
But as I said, you know, as I've previously just explained, that the tide is turning. And, you know, there are other benefits from actually knowing that you're living with a life-limiting disease apart from the treatment options. You know, being able to put your affairs in order, being able to, you know, have a bucket list and just tick off some of the things you've been meaning to for a number of years. So it's not just all about, you know, improving outcomes and survival. There are more, you know, just personal things that can be, you know, have a benefit from knowing what you're living with.
So in terms of detection, what's used for detecting mesothelioma?
Generally speaking, patients often, their first sign of something being wrong is that they feel breathless. You know, that the same walk they do every day, that they suddenly feel breathless or their breath is going up the stairs, usually end up going to the GP, and a chest x-ray is often the first investigation that they'll have. This will show that they've got some fluid collecting around their lung, and will result in a referral to the local hospital. And usually one of the first things they'll do is a CT scan. And it's the CT scan, really, that's the first indicator that there is something wrong with this pleural lining, this lining of the chest cavity. Mm-hmm. Once they've identified that there's a problem with that lining of the chest cavity, the next investigation is a biopsy, usually, so we can get a little bit of that old abnormality under the microscope. And there's lots of ways we can do a biopsy. We might put you back in the CT scanner, we might give you a local anaesthetic and just put a camera into the between the ribs and drain the fluid and take a biopsy, or we might get the surgeon to see you, who might put you to sleep and do a more invasive procedure. But generally, it's chest x-ray, CT scan, followed by a biopsy by some means.
Okay, and if you know, if I'm aware of the fact that 20, 30 years ago I was exposed to a reasonable amount of asbestos, is there any mileage in me actually having any kind of regular checks, or is it not worth the...
That's a tough one, really. So there isn't any evidence to suggest what the best thing is to do here, but it's something that we at the charity get asked a lot. We've got a free phone helpline open every day, and it's something we get asked a lot by clinicians and patients. There is some small-scale work being done in Western Australia where they have got quite a problem with asbestos-related diseases because they mined blue asbestos in the north of Western Australia.
Right.
And they've done some early screening people. So, and it would suggest that we may pick up some early diagnosis through screening in a targeted way. So people with really high exposure. And the kind of screening they do is just annual examination by a GP and a chest x-ray. So that's in very, you know, patients, people that have had high exposure for a number of years, so people who have worked in and around the mines or lived with people who worked and lived in and around the asbestos mines. So generally speaking, in this country, no, there isn't anything really that we can do, but there may be evidence coming out in the future that for people with high exposure, that it might be worth them having an annual chest x-ray and clinical examination.
Okay. So, Yes to Life, that I'm the chairman of, is a charity that helps people kind of look outside the box. And I imagine there's plenty of people with mesothelioma that are looking everywhere they can for anything that might help them, even with, you know, just helping them with their quality of life, helping them any life extension. Do you know particularly of anything that people have found to help them, or any forums that people are going on where they're sharing information on techniques that may help them?
I think over the years, because of, you know, I mean, I've had patients describe mesothelioma as being a man devoid of hope, or being set out to sea in a boat without any oars. You know, that's how desperate people with mesothelioma. So over the years, because of how desperate people have felt, I think I've been told about every different alternative or complementary treatment that there is going. When asked, I would say there are some good common sense things that people can do for themselves in terms of, you know, controlling pain, making sure they get rest because they're, you know, controlling their pain, looking at their diet and just eating, you know, a nutritious diet. Exercise is really important. You know, it's amazing how quick people decondition when they're struck down with any ill health.
Yes.
You know, if they're not doing very much physically, they'll soon decondition. So hanging on to your functional ability and really challenging yourself with exercise. So they're the good common sense things that I would always talk to patients about. There are only, there's only two websites that I recommend people to access when looking at complementary or therapies. One of those is CancerNet, and that's Professor Robert Thomas from Adam Brooks Hospital.
Yeah,
it's called CancerNet.
He's great.
And the other one is CancerActive.
Yeah.
So Chris Woolland, I think, sets up CancerActive. So they're the two sites I recommend.
Okay.
And I would say, whatever, you know, there's lots of people out there who are quite happy to take money off people who are very desperate. So be very sceptical about alternative therapies particularly, and always discuss it with your local healthcare team. You know, don't be afraid to bring it up in the consultations and just talk to the people that are helping you manage your disease about what you've explored. Because, you know, there are, if we just look at, you know, the use of curcumin, for instance, there is some evidence that is, you know, good quality evidence that suggests that that has, you know, good anti-cancer properties and may be a benefit. So, you know, and a good clinician with a science background will talk to you about that. I think Karen wants to come in as well.
I just wanted to say that I think there's a lot of people who feel very, very isolated with this disease. But what I've been struck by coming into the team has been the experience of coming across the support groups that have been set up across the country. And they are very, very useful forum for people to talk to others in the same situation, learn from the experiences they've had, but actually mixing it in with a social agenda. So it's not all about sitting there talking about mesothelioma. It is about having going on various social activities at the same time, having the opportunity to talk to other people who are attending the same group. And so I would always suggest that anyone who is feeling particularly alone with their condition, or even if they're not, to look at where their nearest social group is and just to see whether it's something that would suit them and support them going through this journey.
Sounds great. Yeah, very important. In terms of looking that up, is this something that Mesothelioma UK has a list of support groups, or how would you find them?
If you look up on the Mesothelioma UK website, you will find those support groups.
Excellent.
And if you have any doubts about which is nearest or what have you, then contact the helpline and someone will answer that question for you.
Great. So I wanted to just finish off, Karen. Maybe you could tell me what you expect to be doing in your new post.
Well, I'm based locally at Leicester, and Leicester is quite a big centre for attracting people coming for advice and opinion about managing their treatment, managing their disease. And those people coming from all over the country. We have people coming from quite in the northeast, the northwest, and also Northern Ireland, down from the south. So there's a lot of tertiary referrals, people who are not local to Leicester, and they are people I am concerned about, that I will be getting more involved with themselves and their carers, so that they don't feel isolated, and so that I can help plug them into their local support if there is support there, or equally if there isn't, by providing a phone-based support for them from Leicester. So that's quite a prominent role. My other responsibility is to Mediastinium in UK, working with the helpline with all my other Mediastinium UK clinical nurse specialists who are in posts around the country. So I have a kind of a local role, but also a regional and national one. So there's a lot to be done. I have an interest personally in research and looking at patient experience of mesothelioma. So I hope to be exploring that a little bit more as well as part of my role.
Great. All right. Well, I'm sure that'll be very much appreciated. And every bit of attention that's given to this intractable disease will be, is worthwhile. All right. Well, look, I think we're going to wrap it up there. Thanks so much for talking to us today, both of you, Karen and Liz, and helping make everybody more aware of this enormous plague that we have as a legacy from the 20th century and, what we're trying to do about it.
You're welcome. Thank you. Yeah, thank you very much.
Well, there's some shocking facts in there. So it's great to hear that there are some advances in helping being made, although anything like a cure seems a long way off. If there are any integrative medicine specialists listening with experience of helping people with mesothelioma with any useful supportive approaches, do let me know so I can pass them on. Next week, I shall be talking to a personal coach or trainer, Kenny DeCruz. Many people find that a mentor as a reference point to support them through the bewildering challenges and choices of cancer can be enormously helpful. I hope you'll make a point of listening again. Goodbye.